Thanks for listening to the Best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
Djokovic got it done over Roger Federer. And in just absolutely epic five-setter. I said on the Jason Martin Show yesterday on Fox that you needed to get up and watch this because we live in a very blessed time as it relates to sports in America, being sports fans. Because, and I guess you could say this in any generation, but Jeff, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about the guys that we've gotten to watch basically their entire careers. And just how privileged we should be to have the opportunity to watch something like we watched yesterday, because we're watching maybe the best to ever do it. And another guy that somehow is underrated just because I don't know that his name registers with guys that aren't bigger sports fans the same way that a Federer or a Nadal do. But I mean, past just the tennis, 7-6. 7-6, 13-12 were the three sets Djokovic won. He lost 6-1 and 6-4 in the others. And that's his fifth championship at the All England Club. And he's got a winning record over Roger Federer. And it's just outstanding to watch these three guys in particular do what they do. But I'm sitting here thinking about it. And I'm thinking about, we got to watch, or we have gotten and are getting to watch, all of Tom Brady's career. We saw all of Kobe, all of MJ, all of LeBron James, all of Peyton Manning. I mean, the list goes on and on. Depending on how old you are, it continues to go back. But even right now, we're seeing some of the best to ever do it. Now, sports have changed, but just some of the scoring and some of the shooting. Steph Curry. We're seeing all of Steph Curry's entire basketball career. And the name that always hits the top of the list for me is... We saw all of Tiger Woods' career. We're still watching it.
Right.
But there is a snippet in time that we have gotten to live at the turn of the century here and even mid to late 90s to now where we're seeing some of the greatest to ever do it in all sports. I mean, if you want to go even further in individual sports, because that's what we're talking about with tennis and Tiger Woods, you can think about Mike Tyson. You can think about things like that. But you can also think about Michael Phelps. And Usain Bolt, and even some of the greatest Olympians that we've ever seen in some high-profile sports, Katie Ledecky and what she's doing as a female swimmer. I don't know that we actually stop because you and I have to continue to watch these things day after day, and sometimes it gets lost in the shuffle that there's 162 Major League Baseball games and 82
<That's a lot>.
regular season NBA games and 16 NFL games. But if you could stop long enough to exhale, to wake up yesterday to breakfast at Wimbledon and watch this five-setter between two of the five best to ever pick up a tennis racket, I think you can actually just appreciate why we're blessed enough to be able to talk about this for a living, because this stuff's extraordinary, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, look, Federer won at least six games in every set and lost. It's amazing. So
this is
where and we talk about social media a lot. I know Clay focuses on it a lot. Where social media is actually a plus, I think, for the sport of tennis. So yesterday I was busy in an event. I had to make up and watch this later. Watch all the highlights. And all of Twitter was like, "You have to watch this match. You have to watch this match. Put on the tennis. Put on the tennis." I feel like, I don't know, maybe I just wasn't paying attention when I was younger. We didn't have social media, but it felt like you couldn't get this sort of attention to, and I don't want to say tennis is not really a fringe sport, but to not a major sport in America, you couldn't get the attention to watch this match if you didn't sit down to watch it purposely. I think people went to watch this yesterday. Like, for example, I would have put this on if I was in front of a television, because people on social media were like, "You have to go watch this. It's amazing. Go watch it." And so I think that's actually helping viewership and helping grow a sport. Because, like I said, I was busy yesterday, and I was looking for a television because people were telling me how great of a match it was, and obviously it was. And thankfully, they put in the tiebreaker situation. This is the first year they've done it, and I don't know if they thought they'd get to it when it was 12-12. Imagine how long it would have lasted if they didn't have that possibility. Right. We could still be playing tennis now, and people talking about playing 5 hours and in the heat that, that it was there. Pretty amazing. And to your point about we get to watch kind of the best play right now, I do feel like every generation probably said that.
Probably.
Right? I feel like we're getting – our athletes now are getting big. Well, I don't feel they are. They're getting bigger, stronger, and faster. Maybe we'll talk about this at some point today. I don't know if you read that article. Baxter Holmes article. Mm-hmm. Very fascinating, by the way, his article. I mean, we're seeing athletes now bigger, stronger, faster, and you know, a lot of specialization early in life. But you know, people are focusing more on sports at an earlier age now. We're getting athletes. We're producing athletes at that rate. So we're getting to see the best. We're seeing child prodigies end up being successful in their pro sports. And you're right. There's a plethora of sports. If you're a sports fan, there's plenty of great athletes to watch. There's great teams to watch. There's apps to watch it on. There's social media to watch it on. And it's pretty amazing. You know, if you want to get your sports fill, you can do it now with the amazing athletes we have, just in our country, but worldwide. And it's fun. It's fun to be a sports fan right now. There's a lot of intriguing stories. The NBA free agency just ended, but the NBA free agency is better than the NBA regular season, which is remarkable.
And the regular season is going to be great this year, I think.
Well, so the Clippers. So Kawhi's going to play 60 games, right? Mm-hmm. The Lakers, AD and LeBron, how many games are they actually going to play together? But those are West Coast teams, and they're not on until 10:30 Eastern. And there's like 40 million people in the East Coast. They're not going to stay up and watch those games. That's a big problem for the NBA.
Well, I think they're going to address that. I think that there's already been speculation of starting the games on the West Coast earlier. I know that's going to displace some of those live fans out there and deals, but East Coast money in terms of television is huge.
So the San Francisco Giants, the baseball team that I follow, did that this year. They moved their home games from 7:10 to 6:35. So it's actually nice. I don't know if they continue to do that, but early in the season, at least, I was able to watch, you know, three or four innings, five innings before I ended up going to sleep. So that's something that they either have to address, or they have to put them like on national TV on the weekends more often to get that earlier time slot. But that's a problem for the NBA. I mean, it really is. But free agency is wild in the NBA. So there's just, to your point, the summer used to be dead, and now we have all these events in the summer that we're able to talk about, because we've done summer radio now for 3 or 4 years. It can be very tough to do summer radio, but I feel like this week we have plenty of things to talk about.
Yeah, and you never know what's going to bubble up to the surface this week while we're doing it. I spend a lot of time decrying social media. I also know that there's a lot of positives about it. I do think that there's never been a better time to be a sports fan, in that you are engaged, should you want to, and especially if you know how to put together lists on social media of people that are actually worth following and getting away from the refuse that you can also find out there, because you can certainly get lost in that muck and in that swamp. But you're technically in the midst of a conversation with millions of other people watching the exact same thing. You can read experts. You can read former players like yourself, Jeff. You can read people in the media. You can just talk about it with your sphere of influence, your friends, your family, however you want to do it. Social media interconnects us to sports, where you can watch something like last week's Home Run Derby in that second round. Yeah. Where it was just outstanding to sit there and watch, and you saw historic numbers of home runs leaving that yard, especially with Jock Peterson and with Vlad Jr. And you're constantly engaged during the NCAA. Even when it's a bad call, having Twitter during that time can be a lot of fun. Same thing with the NFC Championship game. Sorry, Saints fans. But being there to watch social media, to respond to people, to look at the people that you admire, that you care about what they have to say, and having instant reaction to that. Things have changed so great. And so the question that I have for everybody out there, and the telephone number is 877-99 on Fox. That's 996-6369. You should already have it plugged into your phone anyway, so you can call all the shows all day long and just rattle off whatever takes that you might have. But and I think that this depends on age, and I hope maybe throughout the course of the show, maybe we will get some older callers and some younger callers. Who do you feel most privileged as a sports fan during your life to have gotten to watch? After watching Federer and Djokovic yesterday, for me, it's Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
Tiger Woods is once in a lifetime He really is. I mean, and I've gotten to watch a good bit of Jack Nicklaus's career as well, which is, I mean, you could argue those are the two best to ever do it, but I have never gotten more enjoyment out of watching someone do what they do than watching Tiger Woods throughout his golf career, particularly before the accident.
I think Tiger's got to be up there for me. I mean, he turned a whole generation into golf fans, and we saw when he won the Masters this year, the reaction on whether it was social media or just in the gallery, around Augusta, whatever it was. We saw the reaction of everyone there. Everyone was rooting for Tiger Woods to win and finish on down the stretch. I mean, I'm a little biased. I'm a Giants fan, but seeing Barry Bonds as a kid and growing up, and look, talk about the steroids, go ahead. He was the best hitter of the generation. I know people are going to throw Griffey in my face. No, go look up the stats. It wasn't close. And watching him do what he did for that time period, even though, yes, he was using, I get all that, but that swing was still pure. He still had to hit the ball. And so Bonds to me. And then look, I mean, Shaq is... quite possibly the most physical dominant basketball player of all time. I think we forget because we see him on TNT now, and he's funny and goofy. Dude, he was taking other 7-footers, backing them under the basket and dunking on them like nothing. And that's when he was a little bigger in Los Angeles. I mean, he was Giannis-ish before in Orlando, right? Running the floor, more back to the basket. Wasn't shooting threes like Giannis was, and wasn't really at the top of the key making moves. But I think just kind of body structure. He was just tall and thin.
He could run too.
Running down the court.
He ran like a deer.
Yeah, running down the court. He did bring the ball up every now and then for fun on a fast break. But dude could move at 7 feet. I mean, he's the most physically imposing NBA player I've ever watched by far. And then he got older and whatnot. But nonetheless, so I think to me it's Tiger, Shaq, Barry Bonds. And look, I'm not a big tennis guy, so I'm not going to throw one of those guys in there. On the football side, it's tough. I don't think there's... I mean, Tom Brady is an easy answer. You want to watch him for all these years. But I don't have that connection to Tom Brady in football as I do those players to those sports.
Yeah, and I think that that's fair. I also wonder how many people, and I was thinking about this yesterday watching that match, how many people can look at what we're seeing right now, where we're getting towards the end of the career of Federer. We're at least approaching the end of Nadal's career. Djokovic isn't going to play forever. And if you sat there and you were transfixed or mesmerized by that 5-setter yesterday, 4 hours and 57 minutes, the longest final in Wimbledon history. 68 games, 422 points, 35 aces combined between Federer and Djokovic. I wonder if people have stopped and thought about, man, I wish I had been watching all of this for the last decade, for the last 15 years, for the last 20 years. Because for me, tennis was the sport I played in high school. It's what I lettered in. And I loved it. And I happened to be a teenager during the greatest kind of renaissance of American men's tennis in particular ever. This is kind of before the Williams sisters really began to emerge, but it was Sampras. It was Agassi. It was Jim Courier. It was Todd Martin. It was Malvia Washington. It was Michael Chang. I mean, it was absurd. I remember Todd Martin came and did like a skills deal before a tournament in the city I grew up in. And hundreds of kids, including me, were there to work with Todd Martin. It was absolutely outstanding. And I just think that people watched that yesterday who have watched maybe two or three matches that just don't really pay all that attention to tennis and started to think, I kind of wish that I had access to everything that these guys had done, because eventually they will step aside, and I don't know that we're going to ever see a Federer again. It took a long time to see one of them. Some of these individual sports, it can be different.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We've got our buddy Alex Marvez. He's at Alex Marvez on Twitter. Alex, what's up, my friend?
I am doing great. I am sort of about 80% recovered from, physically, mentally, emotionally from calling the All Elite Wrestling action on Saturday night. As you know, my side gig now working with AEW, but also getting ready for the start of NFL training camps. Broncos kicking it off this week on the 17th, 2 days from now. They'll have their guys reporting, and we got some real football to talk about at that point.
Yeah, I've got to respond to emails you send, too. I just remembered. I haven't said, I need to send you an email back. That's not good work by me, but good job this weekend in that sweltering heat.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It was hot. It was hot in Jacksonville. Saw Calais Campbell, by the way, who looked in unbelievable shape. And, you know, it's been an interesting career for Calais. I mean, I'm not sure if we're going to get to the Pro Football Hall of Fame with him, but someone who I think as each year goes by starts getting more and more in the conversation. He was at the show. Miles Jack was at the show. And a pivotal year for the Jags, by the way. You talk about a team a little bit under pressure to produce. This will be year three of the Coughlin-Marone regime and seem to have lightning in a bottle in 2017. And then last year, the wheels just fell off on this team in so many different ways, and it looks like the Indianapolis Colts have lapped them as far as getting back on their feet and being ready to push to win this division. We know the Texans should be pretty good. Tennessee, sort of a mystery team. If the Jags go in the fourth place again, not so sure everyone's coming back in 2020.
Well, just because you talked about the Jaguars and about that division, are you surprised that the Colts didn't spend more of the money that they had available? Or you just feel like Chris Ballard is discerning in that way and that he knows that his team's in pretty good shape and he's not just going to go jump and spend money. He's going to make sure it's right and at the proper time.
I think the latter is a great point. Look at Justin Houston, for example, right? He became available right place, right time, and they had the ability to sign him, and he's going to fit in really well in that rotation. But what Chris Ballard is building, look at all these second-round picks. I mean, that he's got, and third-round picks, and how he's building his team because he trusts his scouting staff and because there's a set formula for which they are drafting. They know what type of offense they want to run. They know what type of defense they want to run, the Tampa 2. He's able to find players that fit into that and does a fantastic, so far has done a fantastic job, you know, accumulating talent. We haven't talked about any of his high picks being busts or bad or anything like that. So when you're doing it the percentage he's doing it, you can use free agency wisely. And also, look, keep stockpiling cash to be able to keep these players in the fold. You're not going to be able to retain everybody, but to be able to keep these guys. Plus, let's be real here about Andrew Luck, too. He's making about $27 million a year right now. If he keeps playing like he did last season and reemerges as a top-tier quarterback, which I think we can say that he is again, you're going to end up having to redo his deal at some point because he'll have outplayed it, so you're going to need cash available for that as well. But I think they've done an incredible job, you know, just knowing what they are as a team. And it's amazing. Sometimes the best things that ever happen to you are the things that don't. I think one of the best things that happened to the Colts was not hiring Josh McDaniels and getting snubbed by him and bringing in Frank Reich, because he's been a fantastic hire so far.
So yeah, I agree. So when you look at, I hate to say guys aren't worth money. I like to see anybody that can make money make it. A lot of these careers are very, very short, and sometimes it can feel almost like a, you know, like a slaughterhouse at times. It's like once you've outlived your usefulness, then that's a wrap. But I'm sitting here and I'm listening to Melvin Gordon, and I'm looking at him trying to get paid, and I'm seeing a guy that's gotten injured in three consecutive seasons who I don't know necessarily I can trust from an injury perspective. And somebody that I just don't know about paying running backs, Alex. How do you feel about Melvin Gordon and the decision that the Chargers have in front of them?
You know, the analytics tell you one thing, right? That running back is a fungible position, that, you know, it can, you know, it's not that important to your team. But let me just say this. We could talk about C.J. Anderson with the Rams, but C.J. Anderson wasn't Todd Gurley. If you have a healthy Todd Gurley playing in Super Bowl 53, is it a different outcome? I mean, it wasn't like the Patriots blew the Rams off the field, right? But without Todd Gurley, they became a very one-dimensional offense. The Patriots simply didn't have to worry about running the football. And notice what the Patriots did. They invested a first-round pick in Sony Michel, and he was one of the big differences in this game. The guy had a really strong outing, and they've, you know, obviously reconfigured their offense to go around a running back who they made a significant first-round investment in. The problem with Melvin Gordon is this. He and his agents, they needed to be doing this in February. You needed to start laying, you know, planting the seeds, you know, for your crop, you know, early enough, right? And I say that because now, no teams that needed a running back, J-Mart, earlier on this offseason, they already filled it, whether it was in the draft, whether it was, you know, in free agency. But by and large now, there is no team that you can say, wow, there is this huge glaring running back need that they absolutely have to make a trade to get Melvin Gordon. Because remember, you make the trade, you're not only sending away a high draft pick, you're also having to sign Melvin Gordon to the type of contract he wants. So it's trying to get two things done at once. Had they done this whole protest earlier on, the Gordon camp, before the start of free agency, well, maybe then the Chargers can find a trade partner and a team can make, you know, arrange for those things to try to get the contract done. At this point, I think Melvin Gordon's a man without a country, so to speak. He's not going to get traded. I don't see that as a viable option. So that just leaves you having to play for the paltry sum of $5.6 million. And, you know, look, I'm not crying crocodile tears in that regard. He got a first-round contract as a mid-round pick a couple years ago. I can understand Melvin Gordon not wanting to have the wear and tear put upon him, realizing, hey, the iron, I should be, you know, striking now while the iron is hot, so to speak. And, you know, this is, I should be paid because I'm a great running back. And he really is. I mean, he's fantastic for them. And the Chargers would go piecemeal with Austin Eckler and some other backups, Johnson, the running back from Northwestern, they still have on their team. But that being said, I think ultimately Gordon's leverage just isn't that great. I think he comes back. I think he plays, may not be happy. And maybe he can get a deal done with the Chargers. But this deal, I don't think it pushes the Chargers under any pressure of threats of Melvin Gordon not showing up. I don't think it inches them any closer to working out a deal.
You know, a lot of players are upset at this time of year with the one new contract. A lot of it kind of stems back to the CBA and kind of the structure of our guaranteed deals. There's a lot of talk now about trying to get a CBA, a new CBA ratified before the start of the season. I think a lot of that is stemming from the TV contracts that will be up after the season. Is this just talk, or do you think they're actually going to try to get something done this summer?
It sounds like the gravelly voice of Jeff Schwartz, by the way, on the other end of the
phone. It is.
Yeah, you don't say.
Give it a talk to
Alice. It's good. You mean the CBA that's paid your brother very handsomely, right? Just wanted to make sure.
Yes, who had to redo his deal because didn't have enough guaranteed money. But yes, the CBA.
Yeah, exactly. And he had a great agent. He's had a great agent who's helped him out. I would say that as well. And let's tip of the cap to Derek Gilmore and those guys for helping him get his cash. But you know what? It's not just the TV money. It's the gambling money, too. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Once the NFL names an official gaming partner and signs that deal, there is so much of a chance here that the salary cap is going to explode in ways that we've never seen before. For example, let's say that to be an official NFL gambling partner, to have, I'm just going to use a widget name, MGM, right? To have MGM, you know, like we see in soccer games, if you do watch soccer, you know, but I'm just saying. But, you know, on the banner ads, right, that take place, Premier League, you know, when you see a gaming partner that's put out there. Well, can you imagine that during an NFL game and how much money you could be driving by sending people to go gamble on your games? And if the NFL gets back a slight percentage, I'm talking about 0.5%, because that's something that they were seeking, remember, right, when it came to the legislation. I mean, Jeff, the cap is just going to go crazy. And that's something so the NFLPA has to be wondering about, oh, well, what are those figures going to look like? And, you know, do we need to be maybe even asking for more? Well, you know, those types of things when it comes to a labor contract. So I think that, look, for the NFL, it's smart to try to get this done early. NFL teams, as we saw the Green Bay Packers last year, made $477 million, am I correct, in revenue? You know, and I mean, they spent a lot of money because they're building up Titletown for real and buying up a lot of properties and investment in infrastructure and Aaron Rodgers contract, whatever you want to say about it. But, you know, teams are making a lot of money. The question is for the NFL Players Association, what is it that you want? Do you want shorter rookie contracts? Do you want it so that your first-round picks aren't tied up for 5 years and then have, you know, two potential franchise tags waiting for them after that? Essentially, you know, just with that hanging over their head and knowing that the team that drafts them, they may not even become a free agent until 7 years in. I mean, why does the NFL keep contracts relatively down, right? Well, it's not the NBA where players, it's, you know, they find ways because there's no franchise tag to be able to play out their deal and then hit real free agency. Not like that in the NFL. A lot of times, guys, Jeff, you know this, they sign deals because they know they're not going anywhere.
Right.
So they may as well cash in because they realize that the team's not going to let them go easily, and there are real challenges into trying to play out your contract. So I think those are some things for the PA. But the big question is, what does this group of players want from the CBA? The last time your leadership back in 2011, they thought it was great to get reduced practices, right? I mean, that's what it was. Yeah. Cut back the off-season program because it was a monster. That was a huge deal for them. You know how NFL owners feel about that, right? Yeah, go ahead. We don't care.
They don't care.
Let the coaches handle it. Right. The coaches can handle the players. And, you know, if it waters down the product on the field or we don't have the type of player development we used to have, well, so be it. We're still cashing in because most fans aren't going to know the difference. And you know what? They were right.
They're right. It's interesting that you mentioned that. There was some chatter this week on Twitter about, you know, making the testing for marijuana different in the CBA and things like that. And look, I mean, it's barely a test now. I would not focus on that. But, you know, you talk to players maybe more in the locker room than I do. I don't know what they're thinking this year. I have no idea what they want. I mean, what I think players should fight for is more of a guaranteed contract. You're never going to get full guaranteed deals. That's not realistic. Too many players, but some form of guaranteed deals and obviously better health insurance. What are the players thinking this year? Do you have any idea? Because I really I really don't. And if we're trying to limit Goodell's power, which is, while we might disagree with it, it barely affects 1% of NFL players. And again, the testing for marijuana happens once a year, guys. Just don't fail it. You know when it is. Don't fail it.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't, you know, and listen, not every player smokes pot, too. I mean, you know
correct.
What I'm saying? I mean, Schwartz, they're not like, okay, no, I'll just leave that off the field. I'm kidding. But the point is that, you know, like for a lot of guys, it's a non-issue, right? It's a non-starter because they don't partake, so it doesn't matter to them. And the weird part about the Players Association is this. The guys who are the leaders now are not going to be playing by the time that the CBA is anywhere close to expiring. Right? And that's a question that you have about your union leadership. You know, and remember, too, that the way that they now vote is a little bit different, and things have been very, you know, structured in such a way that Demora Smith is able to keep his job and keep rolling on with a very small group, a concentrated group of leaders that are influencing the Players Association. I think ultimately revenue and money is what it comes down to in revenue streams and trying to just increase, you know, whether it's the salary cap, whether it's contract structure, it comes down to money. Because, Roger Goodell being the overseer of NFL personal conduct, that's just sort of gone by the wayside because, like you say, it's such a small group of players that are getting into issues that nobody's really clamoring to say, oh my gosh, I don't care, because it doesn't affect them. I mean, it's like when we talk about NFL headlines in the offseason, 99% of the guys are doing everything right off the field in terms of not being scumbags, not being arrested, etc., but it's a 1% that ends up getting headlines, right? But it paints the NFL in a certain type of brush. It's a great question, though. What is the future of the NFL? I really think the rookie salary cap is something that is a consideration just because of how it has, you know, in some ways really just chilled free agency, and you got to talk about the franchise tag. It's weird because it does affect just such a small group of players that are involved, but those are players that are salary drivers, so to speak.
Correct.
So what happened, and I say a salary driver, someone whose contract helps raise the market for everybody. It used to be that the rookies, remember like a Sam Bradford getting $50 million guaranteed before ever setting foot on the field? He was a guy that would drive salaries. Well, that's gone, and now you've restricted free agency as well. I mean, this was a big step backwards by the PA in a lot of points for the things that the union used to fight for back in the day, starting in 1970 with, you know, John Mackey driving the truck as the first NFL Players Association president challenging the Roselle rule. So I think free agency is really a key for the NFLPA, but again, hard to say from their leadership. They're a little bit tight-lipped about what they're looking for exactly.
Alex Marvez, our guest. He's on Twitter, Alex Marvez. You can certainly follow him there. Alex, 18 games, go. I don't even have to ask the question. That was the story that kind of broke over the last handful of days, and Demora Smith came out and said, look, we are sort of talking about it. Doesn't sound like it's particularly likely or imminent, but we hear about this every couple of years. How much fires behind this smoke this time?
Right. Well, it's something that they continue to discuss, especially in this labor agreement, because Roger Goodell, and if this is indeed, like a lot of folks have speculated, his last NFL labor agreement. In other words, Roger works till about 2023, 2024, and then drives off to Maine and lives in his vacation home and you know, moves on to another point of his life. And, you know, might even be political office like his father. It could be anything that Roger Goodell does next. We'll see how that goes. But, you know, one of the things that he wanted to get done, if I'm not mistaken, was 20, I believe it's 27 million, it's 25 million, I'm sorry, one more time, $25 billion in revenue for the NFL by the year 2027. And what's a way that you can sell that? Well, through more games, right? And selling television packages and spinning off the value of those packages. Let's say one network has the first 9 weeks of NFL programming and then sells it to another network for 9 weeks of NFL programming, let alone streaming rights and things that we're not even seeing right now, technology in the future that is going to change the way that the game is viewed as well. And one of the reasons the NFL is so popular is because of its availability on regular TV and the fact that it's pretty much DVR proof. You have very few people who, you know, oh, I'm going to tape it and then no spoilers, I'll watch in the morning. It doesn't really work like that. It forces your eyeballs to watch the game live, and at that point, you're able to sell products. So it works for the networks and able to work with advertisers and things like this. So the more games, the better advertising packages you can sell, the more that it rises in value to the networks. The problem is the human capital involved in all this, and players involved in an NFL game, and Jeff can speak to this because he's done it. It's like being in a car crash every once a week for 16 weeks of the season with 1 week sprinkled in between to let you heal your body. I just don't think that the way that the game is played today that NFL players, they realize that their bodies can only take so much. Mentally, they can only take so much. And really, fans, you know, and we'll see, because I'm sure there were naysayers. Oh, the 16-game schedule in 1978 is going to ruin us all. Let's stick with 14 games. You know, look, the league survived and flourished. But 18 games, guys, I mean, things that I'm not looking forward to if that ever happened. A 3-9 team having us play out the final six games coaches who know they're going to get fired, players who know they're going to be gone. I mean, it's just, you know, it just kills it. And fortunately, in my opinion, the NFL Players Association, it's a non-starter. Unless the league gives them the type of offer that they simply can't refuse, like a huge amount of percentage increase, and I'm saying 3-4% of total revenue. So we're going to give to you to be able to expand this schedule to 18 games. Oh, and by the way, I'm not sure if you realize this, under the collective bargaining agreement, the NFL actually has the right to expand to 18 games. They don't need the NFL Players Association's approval to do this, but I think that they're proceeding, you know, in such a way that they don't want all the players to just walk off the job and say there's no way we're doing an 18-game schedule. So far it's been a non-starter. Unless the NFL wants to pony up a lot of cash, J-Mart, I do not see an 18-game schedule happening.
Alex, you're the best, man. We will talk to you again soon, my friend. Appreciate it.
So much fun, guys. Thanks so much.
Take care, bud.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
I do want to talk a little bit about Melvin Gordon, Jeff. Melvin Gordon entering the fifth-year option of his rookie deal, $5.6 million. I mean, he's been prolific if you look at some of the numbers. 38 touchdowns over the past 3 years. He had fumbling issues as a rookie, but now just 4 fumbles and 862 touches over the last 3 years. However, just 1 16-game season played. Missed 9 games over these 4 years. Knee injuries, a hamstring issue last year, yeah. A hip sprain in 2016. And at a position, and you can speak to this, it's a replaceable position. It's right. Even something where you don't usually go grab a top 5 running back. If you do, sometimes you end up with Trent Richardson. You can find a Kamara a little bit later on. You can find guys that can tote the rock for you later on. So I look at Melvin Gordon. I know he's really good. I know the Chargers are better with him on the field than they are without him. But he wants Le'Veon Bell money. He wants David Johnson money. He wants that kind of loot. And I look at that and I say, if I'm the Chargers, I might have to let Melvin Gordon walk before I give up this deal because at this point, I just don't know that you can put stock in that. Like, there's just too many things about it, too many variables I don't like.
Well, so many things to talk about here. And Alex brought up the running back value question. It's been a big topic of conversation really for a couple years now with analytics evolving in the NFL. And to your point, you can draft whether it's – I know Kareem Hunt's dealing through some things right now, but he's an example, right, Kareem Hunt?
Yeah.
Third-round draft pick. Jordan Howard, who really fell out of favor with the Bears, now with the Eagles. I think he's still a good running back. Fifth-round draft pick. You mentioned Kamara, who was a third-round draft pick as well out of Tennessee. So you can find these players outside of the first round. Your Broncos, Phillip Lindsay being an undrafted free agent out of Colorado. And you can find, or you have a Todd Gurley, a Zeke Elliott, right? Saquon Barkley, top 10 draft picks that are also game changers at running back. But we've seen the position be devalued in the NFL. So here's the way I look at running backs. And mind you, I played with D'Angelo Williams and Jonathan Stewart, the first duo to have 1,100 yards rushing each in a season in 2009. I played with Adrian Peterson, his 2,000-yard season. I played with Jamal Charles, I believe, still is the NFL leader, all-time NFL leader, in yards per carry, or yards per attempt, however you want to say it, yards per carry in NFL history, with a minimum like 200 attempts or some, you know, some sort of variable there. So I play with great, great running backs, but the NFL now is not built for the running game, and the value on paying a running back when you do not have your other franchise pieces in place is not worth it, in my opinion. The Chargers, for example, do have those pieces in place, correct? They have the quarterback, they have the left tackle, Russell Okung, they have the pass rushers and Bosa and Ingram, they have the secondary pieces as well with Derwin James and the other players they have. So they, in my opinion, they can afford to pay a running back if they would like. They don't have to. They can. Austin Eckler last year, I think, averaged over 5 yards a carry last year. Mm-hmm. So he was good as a replacement for Gordon as well. Because if your offensive line is good, you can make a running back look good, but vice versa as well. The Chargers do struggle on the right side of their offensive line. So the Chargers, if they were to pay Gordon, I'd be okay with it. Just like if... you know, the Rams, for example, they have their other pieces in place. Okay, you pay a Todd Gurley. There's only one running back, in my opinion, in the entire NFL who is a difference maker to where the offense has got to have him or will not work, and that's Zeke Elliott. He does so much for that offense, whether in the run game or really in the pass game at the backfield, as a screen catcher, as just a short middle of the field, roamer, sidelines, whatever it is. He is so important, in my opinion, to that offense. Only guy in the NFL. So kind of back to the original question, would I pay Gordon? I, as a GM, probably would not. But if the Chargers want to pay him, because they have the other pieces in place, that to me is not a bad decision. Again, running backs devalued. C.J. Anderson, by the way, got pretty upset on Twitter because we're kind of using him as the example as to why you wouldn't pay a running back, because he came right in for Todd Gurley and rushed the ball very well at the end of the season. And part of it is kind of his fault, because he admitted, like, yeah, I'm a little out of shape and I'm a little pudgy right now and blah, blah, blah. Like, that's what it is. It's not that we don't understand C.J. Anderson was or is a very good running back. You remember him, of course, when he was with the Broncos in the Super Bowl. It's that he kind of was like, yeah, like, I'm a little out of shape right now. And he comes in, rushes for 100 yards, and is playing well. And yes, they ran different run plays for him. So that's a long-winded answer to say the value is not there unless you have those pieces in place. And so, yeah, I'd be okay if they paid him. But again, I don't think he has the leverage. To Alex's point, he's doing this at a point where...
Yeah, I was about to ask you that. When you think about that as a former player, and you just look at it from a pure, this is the time that I'm going to make this known. I'm not going to do it when teams could have potentially got me. I mean, the teams that lost out on the Le'Veon Bell sweepstakes, maybe somebody would have been there for Melvin Gordon right there. Like, what do you think of the timing of this choice, considering Melvin Gordon's lack of leverage in this situation?
I mean, I think the Le'Veon Bell decision tells you everything you need to know about the value of a running back, right? I mean, it was not... I think the Jets were kind of bidding against themselves. I'm not really sure who else was in the bidding for Le'Veon Bell. I know people think he got what he thought he'd get. It's kind of less if you look at the deal. It's really a 2-year deal for less than he assumed he would get. I'm guessing that he has tried to work a deal with the Chargers, and they finally said no, and now he's using whatever leverage he has, which is a holding out of training camp, to do that. But to Alex's point, you have to do this before the free agency starts. Or before the draft starts, like a time when you are valuable to other teams. And that probably would have been after free agency, when, like you said, teams had missed out on Le'Veon Bell, or maybe a Mark Ingram, you know, the Ravens ended up signing him. Whoever it was missed out on the running back. But again, we don't see a lot of teams anymore paying running backs that they don't draft. Le'Veon Bell, obviously, that's an example where they did. But look around the NFL. We had the failed DeMarco Murray long-term deal in Philly. Then he went to Tennessee. But we don't see a lot of running backs going to new teams and getting monster contracts because of the wear and tear. And I think teams rightfully feel we can go ahead and draft a player comparable or less comparable or maybe more comparable at that position. We just don't see a lot of teams going out of their way. So his positional value hurts him in this stalemate, because no one's really going to trade for him and give him a new contract. That would be very out of the ordinary of the NFL. We know the NFL typically is very traditional in the way that they handle contracts and certain situations like that. So he has no leverage. It's unfortunate. As, you know, I'm an advocate of players obviously getting as much as they think they're worth, but it's going to be a very tough sell. I mean, every other position, we don't see quarterbacks as often because they don't really ever make it to free agency, but every other position, you see guys getting a lot of money in free agency, and the only one really is running back. Now, running backs get paid on their own team, not when you head to free agency.
Yeah, and then I think the stat, I can't remember, it was a couple of years ago that the average longevity or the length of a career for a running back in the NFL is 3.5 years. Well, now, I know that there's a lot of guys that play longer than that, but it's not – there's a lot of dudes that come out of their rookie deals and don't get big money because of the attrition and the wear and tear on the body.
Well, the average NFL career is 3.5 years. I don't know if it broken into position, but I think you're accurate about that. We just see like the top end guys, obviously, but you know, I play with like Jonathan Stewart, man. I mean, he was he was fantastic. Like he played like 11 years at his size. So, I don't know the exact number for running backs. I feel like you're 3 or 4 a team, but we've seen teams too, and this is something that's interesting as I bring this up. But I know Super Bowl, it's kind of a very small sample size. I'm not sure that it really works well to my argument, because you can definitely say, you know, well, Todd Gurley, you know, helped the Rams get to the NFC Championship game, or get into the Super Bowl, and you can argue that, you know, the Zeke Elliott got the Cowboys division around, and Alvin Kamara got the Saints NFC Championship. Like, you can argue, you know, these sort of arguments, but we've yet to see. Since when? Marshawn Lynch, maybe in 13, when a running back, an elite running back. Sorry, CJ Anderson. I don't really know if you count in 2015 for this, but like an elite running back help a team win a Super Bowl. Because we've seen running back by rotation in New England do it, running back by rotation in Philly do it,
yep,
by rotation in New England again. Now, CJ Anderson in 15 obviously was an elite level running back, but is he up in that category of top 10 running backs in the NFL? Maybe that year he was. 14, the Patriots again. They never really have a running back.
But I mean, 15, they also had an elite defense too.
Correct.
I mean, like, it's never just a running back that's going to win you a championship.
Correct. And it's not like a quarterback that can kind of get you that position. But again, we see like Saquon Barkley on a bad team, right? Le'Veon Bell this year. The Jets will be better, but not the best. I mean, so it doesn't. It's the value of winning a game from that position, I think, is so hard to maybe quantify, but also just it's not there. And that's to my point about you have to pay or find the pieces that matter, really. The quarterback, the left tackle, I would even argue a right tackle now, your good center, you know, you have one or two pass rushers, you have a linebacker that can run with some of these tight ends, and you have a couple secondary pieces. And then it's like, okay, let's get to our running back now.
Yeah. Well, looking it up, the NFL Players Association, average career of an NFL player is 3.3 years. Running back, shortest average of 2.57. Wide receivers, 2.81. Cornerbacks, 2.94. And that's a lot of guys that have a lot of physical contact.
Is there I always wonder this. So is this just an average player, like someone who just is in the NFL on the roster as a rookie, they might not play at all? I've always wondered, like, what is this? What makes this number? Just anyone who's on the roster counts toward this number.
Does the career just start when you're on the field, or if you're not? Yeah, I think that's probably arbitrary.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
I saw you tweet this out. I'm pretty sure I'm applying this to the right person. That when this 18 game thing reared its ugly head again, you suggested. Well, what your thought was. All right, so if a starting quarterback can only play 16 games of the 18 based on that rule, if that were the rule, then you would see everybody top load and put all their best players with the quarterback to win those games, and then the other two games would basically be the equivalent of preseason games with everybody that you had to use because you couldn't use the starters, right?
Yeah, so if you look at the preseason, it's a good example of the preseason. Often if the left tackle is out during the preseason, the starting quarterback is not playing that game. Because obviously we know how important it is to have that blindside protection. It's a little different with the shotgun, and I'm not going to get into those nuances now. But nonetheless, when starting left tackle is out, typically the starting quarterback is out in a preseason game. It could be the third game. Doesn't matter. You're not typically playing that starting quarterback maybe more than a drive or two with a backup left tackle in the game, especially a young player. The same would apply in this hypothetical 18-game schedule where you can only play 16 of the 18 games, is that at least the head coach in charge of the offense, whoever it is, would have all his starters, his high-priced best players, not play all in the same two weekends. You'd have the quarterback sit out. You'd have your best offensive lineman sit out. You have your star wide receiver sit out. You'd have your tight end sit out. You'd have your running back sit out, because you want that unit to all play together. If you have a backup quarterback in the game, I understand the idea of people saying, well, you need the weapons for the backup quarterback, but sure, he's not going to be able to use them in the same manner that the starting quarterback is going to be able to use them in. The chances of winning with a backup quarterback and some stars is not as great as the starting quarterback and all the stars, or the starting quarterback and half the stars because they're sitting out that week. You're not winning that week. So I think the teams would basically take those two games as, all right, those are two losses on our schedule. And if you're a fan, you 1,000% should not support this. Imagine that you are, Jason, you are in Nashville right now, and you have a young kid who's a Marcus Mariota fan, and his parents can afford one game to go to a year, right? We know tickets are very expensive. I appreciate everyone who buys tickets and goes to games. We know food's expensive. Everything. The whole thing is very expensive. And you choose that one game to go to, and he's sitting out one of those two games, not because of injury, just because he's sitting out that week. That is not a good fan experience, obviously.
Yeah, well, is that worse than the NBA, where you're having load management and LeBron doesn't play when they come to your town?
Correct. And this is why NBA, no one watches the regular season. The ratings are down the regular season. They're up regionally, because regional networks are doing well for baseball and basketball. But nationally, they're not doing as well. And the NFL really has never had that problem, because players play all 16 weeks if they're healthy, maybe not week 17. And there's a sense of urgency in the sport because of the 16 games. And every week does matter. And you don't feel that sense of urgency in other sports, especially now we're in the middle of baseball season. And you would lose a little bit of that sense of urgency if you went to this schedule. And again, like I said, you'd see the starters all sit out together, so you're penciling two losses basically. And no one pays to see backup quarterbacks play. Now, you could exempt the quarterback from this rule, but again, I would tell you, man, if coaches feel comfortable where they are with their record, they might not play that quarterback with a backup left tackle in the game, because they don't have to. I get if there's injuries, you have to figure out a way to do that, but this is not an injury situation. And just from an offensive line perspective, is we have a starting unit, right? Of course, there's injuries, guys are in and out, but what if we're just, they're like, hey guys, this week our two guards are not going to play. Like that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous just to shove in two backups because of this weird new scheduling quirk. I think, Jason, that the NFL threw this out there to see the reaction to this idea, because there's reports that this was actually not a real idea, and it's a way for the NFL to get to 18 games and not do it fully, because I actually believe that they would only pay the players for 16 games. So we get paid technically by the game, right? So we get paid every week during the season, even on bye week, so 17 weeks, and we're basically paid for the 16 games we play. We're not paying the offseason. Some bonuses are attached, but very little pay in the offseason. Maybe, I know it's a lot of money. Some people, maybe $5,000-$7,000 in the offseason is all we get from the time offseason program starts to the end of training camp. It's not a lot of money compared to what our salaries are. So the idea of playing this 18-game, 16-game thing for the players, I think they would only try to pay us for the 16 games, even though they're making all this revenue now off the other two games. So what Alex said is true. I think it's a non-starter for players unless we are getting a lot back for this, whether that's better health insurance when we're done playing. I just like I feel like guaranteed contract, Jason, should not be for all NFL players, right? There's too many players, too many guys don't play long. You mentioned the number. Insurance kind of is the same way. I feel like every year you're in the league, maybe you get a couple years tacked on to insurance. I mean, I played 8 years in NFL. My insurance is up in next year, I believe, for the NFL. I mean, wow. I had 6 surgeries in the NFL. I dislocated my toe, and I got to go find insurance now. NFL should cover me. I played 8 years in the NFL. I should get longer than 5 years of health insurance post-career. So there's other things that we should fight for. So that's where I think it's an utter disaster if this were to go that direction. No one, not a single person I saw, player, pundit, fan, liked this idea of the 18-game schedule with only 16 games for each player.
Would this eliminate the bye weeks also? Or would you still have a bye week on top of this? Because technically you could use it as a bye week. And then the other question I have, just from a hypothetical standpoint, would this be a strategic deal where, all right, I'm playing against New England, I don't want to show them anything, so I'm not going to play anybody. I'm going to make the playoffs anyway, and then we'll see them later. But that's a dangerous game to play, because then you might lose home field advantage to them.
I think it was Bill Barnwell who tweeted this out. Like, coaches don't even know how to use their challenges properly. Now we trust them to figure out like how to use their roster properly. Like it was something like along those lines. Maybe it was Robert Mays. Bill Barber, one of those very smart guys.
Yes.
Covered the NFL. So it's true, right? Like there's only just as we know there's only like 10 to 15 good NFL head coaches, really. Or there's a lot of unknowns we have this year, obviously, with new coaches. But, like, not everyone's going to be able to figure this out in a good manner. And so I don't know why we would add more to the coach's plate to try to figure out how this is going to work. Look, the ideal thing is if we're going to 18 games, you give 2 bye weeks.
Right, sure. Of course.
And the season lasts from Labor Day until mid-March, I guess.
And you eliminate a couple of preseason games, right?
Yeah, but you probably still have to have you probably still would have a 3 or 4 week camp.
That'd be fine, but I think two preseason games probably, and then probably, I think you'd also probably have to do combined practices where you had teams.
Most teams already do combined practice to make up.
Well, I mean, like, more of them, but yeah,
there's more. I would say like New England, for example. I think I'm right on this. They value like those more than they value like the preseason game. Is being able to work in that. I've done one of those before. It was in Pittsburgh too. It wasn't very intense. I thought it was going to be crazier, and I think maybe because Coach Caldwell and Coach Tomlin, you know, they told all of us no fighting, and guys kind of kept it, kind of calm in that manner. It wasn't as crazy as I thought of, but it's good work because the Steelers run a defense that we almost never see in the NFL anymore. So you get to work against different guys. When I was in Detroit, you get to go visit their camp and the way that they do things, but. Again, maybe so 2 preseason games, and I saw someone suggest this. It makes sense, Jason. Maybe a third game of just like backups, like the starters just don't play. Like it's a third game, like make the roster type of game.
That's the whole value of the preseason because you're watching preseason. Basically, right. You're watching for 5 positions. Yeah. You're watching for like 5 guys that may or may not make the team that are doing whatever they can to find a home.
Hey, did I tell you that, or did Dave McGinnis tell you that?
I've had multiple people tell me that. I've had Mark Mariani tell me that. I've had a lot of people that ended up making teams, making special teams and things like that because they're out there. They're trying to make the team. It's not for Aaron Rodgers and Ben Roethlisberger and Antonio Brown and Zeke Elliott. It's for the dudes that are on that bottom of the 53.
But I'm glad you mentioned like 4 or 5 guys because there's a common misconception that all 90 guys on the roster are fighting for jobs. Not really, guys.
No.
40 is 53-man roster, right? We got 2 or 3 quarterbacks, 3 specialists, so that's now down to, you know, now down to 48, let's say. Out of those 48 guys, I mean, like 43 are about chosen before camp starts. And you know, whether it's because of contract or because of positional need, whatever the reason is, they're already on the roster. They have to do something really terrible during training camp to not make the team. So there's like 5 spots you're fighting for. A lot of those guys, to your point, 5th linebacker, 6th linebacker, special teams guy, right? A 6th cornerback or 6th defensive back who's a special teams guy. You know, maybe the one swing offensive lineman you have, right? 1 pass rusher. Like there's not many spots actually up for grabs in the preseason. Those games are valuable. So if you go to 2 preseason games, you're losing a lot of opportunities for those guys to play. We know the first game and the 4th game, typically, a lot of those backups play really a lot in the 4th game. And you lose that because the starters would have to play in the first game and the second game. They'd take up maybe a half of the second game. And you don't get that opportunity if you're a young player to show what you can do if you only have 2 preseason games.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.